From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a deeper dive into stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today on Deadline is laying out our outfit and packing a brown bag lunch because it's time for back to school season once again. But it's not as fun as Capri Suns, Lunchables, and Fresh Kicks. This back to school season will see some of the same issues we've been seeing in recent years, and even some new ones. Staffing shortages, behavioral problems, artificial intelligence, and more are setting up staff and kids for a challenging school year. Let's start with what could be the biggest problem, staffing shortages. It's a simple equation. If we don't have enough teachers, students can't be taught, at least not at the level that they should be taught. The U.S. Department of Education estimates that from February to May of 2020, the economy lost 730,000 local public education jobs. That sounds like a lot, and it is. It was about 9% of the field overall. Many of those teachers fled to better-paying and less stressful careers, and a majority of those workers didn't return after the brunt of the pandemic wore off. While the Department of Education notes that there have been improvements to staffing shortages, the situation is far from resolved. Even worse, the education industry as a whole is facing a staffing crisis that affects more than just those standing in front of students explaining algebraic equations. Whether it be bus drivers, substitute teachers, cafeteria workers, or social workers, even coaches and referees, more local education employees are needed across the country. This all sounds like a bummer, we know, but there is a bright side. To give some perspective on how superintendents and school administrators are dealing with these issues, Dr. Robert Mott, the superintendent of Monessen School District in Pennsylvania, joined Odyssey.
So what about school drivers? Is there a shortage in your district?
Yeah, there is. We're very small, so we've got six drivers, but it's very difficult to find drivers. Right now we're okay, but there's always that fear that one, you know, we may lose one and then we're in big trouble. And then what happens is we have custodial people, pretty much all hands on deck help drive kids, vans, buses. So yeah, it can be a problem, definitely.
Dr. Mott, what is the problem? Why are they scarce?
You know what? I'm not sure. It's been like this for the last couple years. I think sometimes maybe the behavior on the buses cannot be as good as they anticipate, and it causes people to not want to do the job.
Yeah, that I would imagine that's a very diplomatic way of saying it. Sometimes the kids, you know, aren't as ruley as you would hope if you're a bus driver. I don't know what I know. Pay scales overall have come up because they've had to attract people to want to do the job, right?
Right. Correct. Yeah, they definitely have, not only with bus drivers, but substitute teachers, too. We increased the pay and still are having some trouble trying to find people to help us out. So that could be a problem for us. And, you know, we can't get the kids to school. Maybe we don't have bus drivers. That becomes a high anxiety for us, too, at the schools.
Dr. Mott, is your district among those that have changed the qualifications, making it a little bit easier for substitute teachers to find employment?
Yes. You know what? We employ substitutes, people that have degrees, and then they can get emergency certified. Yeah, so it makes it a little easier so we can still find people. So increasing the pay, qualifications are easier, a little easier. And you still have to be college educated, but we can emergency search you in certain areas, and then you can become a substitute. And that has helped a little bit, but still, we're struggling with substitutes, bus drivers. It can be difficult, but I think things are turning around. Definitely, we've interviewed some people for some full-time jobs, and we've had a lot of applicants, which has been scarce also, just trying to find a full-time teacher. But over the summertime, we had a few openings, and we had probably two openings. We had probably over 100 applicants. So I think it's starting to turn around, in my opinion.
That's really encouraging, because normally, yes. Superintendent Mott, we hear the opposite, where even people who have called to set an appointment for an interview just don't show up at all.
Yes, that does happen. You know, we've had that happen too, but I'm not sure why that happens either, but that's happened numerous times to us. Like I said, I think we are definitely, it's turning around slowly, and I think in the next couple of years we'll be, you know, hopefully back to some normalcy.
So what's behind educators leaving public schools? pay, high expectations, well-being, lack of leadership, burnout, lack of parental support, and student behavioral issues are all top reasons commonly listed among those who have left or are thinking about leaving education. As far as pay goes, a National Education Association report found that, when adjusted for inflation, the average teacher salary declined 6.4% over the past decade. Also, teachers made on average 23.4% less than other college-educated individuals in 2022. So what does that mean in terms of actual dollars? Emma Garcia, a research manager at the Learning Policy Institute, told The Hill that starting salaries for teachers on average are around $44,530. In addition to issues with pay, there's also what some have been calling the villainization of teachers. While teachers of years past have received respect and a freshly shined apple, today's educators are sharing a different story. Behavioral problems in public schools are becoming a growing concern for many, including Professor Leslie Laveri, who teaches political science at McAllister College.
Could you discuss the evolution of this, how our view of teachers changed?
Sure. I think a lot of us had kids home during the pandemic, and we were able to see on Zoom what was happening when we even got to that point where we could be online. And so at that point, parents were thankful that people were keeping their kids busy and trying to make the best out of a bad situation. But people's patience wore thin fairly quickly. And meanwhile, teachers were keeping this up online, balancing whatever they had going on at home. And then districts started to shift to hybrid, where teachers had kids sometimes in the classroom and online simultaneously, or balanced multiple groups of students. So the workload quickly increased for teachers. And of course, families were more involved in their students' education because a lot of times the kids were at home part of the time. And so there was a craving from families for more individualization, and they felt like they could see everything that was going on in the classroom in a new and different way. So there was a lot more scrutiny. So even though at the beginning people were more thankful for what teachers were doing, with just not that much time passing, all of a sudden people had more demands, and the demands felt really unrealistic to teachers who were balancing multiple agendas from multiple people, multiple modalities of education.
So how can we improve morale since now COVID's over?
So I think part of it is families recognizing that people don't have to be there with their kids. These people have chosen to be in these classrooms because they like students and they like their job and they want to be treated like professionals and respected like professionals. I think there are some institutional things like increasing teacher pay and making sure we have enough adults to support the learning environment so that it's not just the teacher isolated in their classroom, but that we have school counselors, other education support professionals. We have enough bus drivers. We have enough substitutes so that teachers actually get a break and aren't combining classrooms when someone's out sick. And then the other things are about what we can do as not politicians, not institutional changes, to make sure that we appreciate what teachers do and recognize what they do and their role in our society.
I've never understood this reluctance to pay teachers what they should be worth in this society.
Yeah, I don't understand it necessarily either. I've been a teacher. I taught second grade before I went back to graduate school in political science. And part of it is just that there's always competition for what we see as limited funds. People don't want higher taxes. And so if you've got to pay for healthcare and education and safety, and you keep adding on to that list, then the budget gets shuffled. And if this is something you're able to get by without prioritizing, a lot of times that's what happens. We saw a lot of extra funding for schools related to the COVID pandemic to address this idea of learning loss. And that money is now running dry. People were warned that that money would go away and that we couldn't have extra individuals, actual staff in the classroom for a long time to support kids. And now we're seeing that extra staff go away and people being let go. So it's just sort of like one more cut to an open wound, because now we're seeing teachers with less, and it feels like a fiscal cliff. Like, oh, for a minute, we maybe had what we needed and now it's gone. So it really is up to us to say our schools need more support. Look what happens when we have enough adults in the building. Maybe we could devote more money to that.
I have a friend who is a teacher, and she just said she had to retire. She was just too tired after all that, after COVID. Have classrooms become more political battlegrounds for parents after the mask debates and the vaccine mandates?
Yeah, I think so. We saw that in school board meetings for a while, and then some of that has percolated down to the classroom, where teachers are being isolated online. This teacher said this in class, and things that we wouldn't hear or care about before have become more of like a lightning rod, and teachers didn't sign up for that, and they don't like that. I think that politicization is part of a problem. We've also seen a lot more student behavior issues, and that related to how kids were socialized over the pandemic. And so we do need more adults to teach these skills. We do need to have kids interact more with another, and there's going to be tensions as that happens, but it's hard to ask adults who are the troubleshooters to just wait that out, especially if they don't feel like there's enough other support.
In an effort to address some of these issues, districts are trying new tactics to keep kids engaged and to stop them from being disruptive. Some of these new tactics include instituting no phone policies. Any of us who have our own phone or know any young people with a phone might be wondering how that's going. Jennifer Jolly is a Tech Life columnist for USA Today, and she joined Odyssey to share more on cell phone bans being touted by districts across the country.
Oh boy, can you think of a more emotional topic that can send parents off into a frothing rage than the discussion of cell phones and their kids, or for that matter, cell phones and adults and just being present around their kids. Yeah. It's a very fraught topic, but let's take it one at a time. And a lot of schools are implementing cell phone bans for a variety of reasons. And Jennifer, what kind of concerns are these bans raising with parents?
I was just looking. Evanston High School in Chicago is banning cell phones during class, and they can have them in a caddy, but during any instruction time, they have to be tucked away. So that's just one area it's really hitting locally. But we are seeing these bans. Kids are heading back to school with more bans than they have ever faced before. Some of the strictest bans on smartphones in the classroom since really smartphones were invented.
Now, the reason why these districts are cracking down on cell phone usage is not so much as distractions in the classroom, even though I can't imagine this flu, even before we had greater research on just the impact that social media has on young minds. This is also a mental health tool these days, because we're starting to see more and more studies about how social media is being linked to all sorts of negative mental health outcomes.
Yeah, that's right. And educators, lawmakers, even some students now say that cell phones are a constant distraction that take a toll on academic performance and mental health. And the studies, the statistics, they're adding up like crazy. I've been working on a series of stories around this, and it can take kids are getting, right now it says 97% of kids use their phones at school. The average student gets 60 notifications during school hours in a single day and spends 43 minutes, about the same length of a full class period, on their phone. And it can take up to 20 minutes for teen brains to refocus on learning after one distraction. So that's why these bans are happening. And one of the biggest problems in bans taking effect are parents. It's the parents and their own anxiety and wanting to remain tethered and hovering over their kids 24/7.
Look, I understand that. I really do. I think as a parent, you want to make sure your kids are either in sight or virtually in sight. So I do understand that concern. You know, how can they get in touch with us if there's an emergency? How can I keep tabs on them either via a phone or a watch? I mean, that's it used to seem dystopian, but it also provides a great deal of peace of mind.
Yeah, many people are now, you know, there's Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation. There's all kinds of new books out saying, okay, well-meaning parents have overprotected kids now in the physical world and underprotected them in the online world. So as much as, and I fully relate to that fear being real as well. My daughter, when she was in her sophomore year of high school, there was an active shooter outside of her high school. And from the moment that school sent us a notification that they were on lockdown, active shooter, I lost my mind. They said, parents, you need to stay away. Don't text or call your kids. I mean, for those couple of hours, you're just I mean, your life has ended, you know, as you know it. And when she was allowed to get her phone and text me, everything was okay. So I get that. The fear is real. But the damage that it's doing for them to be constantly tethered to parents by tech is real as well. So how do you strike a balance between needing to get in touch with them and also leaving them alone and letting them grow up as we were able to?
While the situation may seem grim, during this time of year, everyone should remember one thing: patience. Whether you're sending your child off to school for their first year or for their last year, it can always be stressful. The same can be said for teachers who are meeting their first year of students or their 30th. Students themselves may also be struggling heading back to the classroom after a summer of unstructured free time. And if you think that teachers will also be rested from a quote-unquote summer break, you should be aware that The Hill reported just this year that nearly half of teachers plan to take a second job over the summer, and 76% said they did some type of professional development. We should also remember this. The National Education Association found that about 20% of teachers also have a second job during the school year to make ends meet or to pay back student loan debt. That makes them three times more likely to have two jobs than people in any other profession, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. One fourth grade teacher, single mother Cassie Head, garnered 3 million views on TikTok with the story of her life as a teacher by day and waitress by night to make ends meet. Another teacher, Ashley Rocketfield, also works two jobs and told Newsweek that despite the nonstop work and financial difficulties, she can't imagine not teaching. Why? Because she loves how happy her students are when they do fun and silly things together, and she loves seeing their progress and how confident they start to feel as they learn. So we should probably all try to take a page out of Ashley's book and try to be kind and patient and know that most teachers are doing their best with limited resources and treat them accordingly. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strouser, and by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.